side, patting the horses, touching the pine needles. Dante hugged his blankets around him and wiggled his fingers and toes. After a while, they stopped hurting. By noon the next day, they dropped out of the mountains and into an endless sea of white-coated hills. The snow was shallow, though, no more than 3 inches, sometimes disappearing entirely in the places where the sun shone unshadowed for most of the day. Compared to the trudge through the pass, the horses all but flew as they walked. They saw no more before the sun had set, and they took shelter in the hollow of a draw. No riders, no farmers, no trails of smoke and civilization. The day after was just as empty. It was as if the snows had wiped away the world. They crossed a ridge, and to the right, a circle of great gray stone blocks stood like the grave markers of all things. Dante pulled his cloak tighter around his shoulders. After that moment, he couldn't shake the sense they were being watched, that there were eyes in the trees, or the dark creases between hills. But he knew that was foolish. People had better things to do than spy on them all day, things like keeping themselves alive, or getting the hell out of these wastelands. Still, it stuck with him, that uneasy creep of a presence among the isolation. He didn't mention it, not wanting to look like a scared little child, and so he just walked on, one more hour, one more day, that much closer to the dead city.
"Ever get the sense we're being watched?" Robert asked the next afternoon.
They'd crested the saddle of a hill and paused to gaze out on all the ones yet ahead of them. Blaze took the break to scare some food from his packs.
"Sometimes," Dante blurted, then waited for Robert to volunteer more.
"Me too. But this time I think we really are."
"Oh?"
"Can't be, though. There's nowhere to move without being seen."
Robert gestured to the open rises of snow. Trees lined the folds of the hills, and sometimes sat in clusters at their base, but mostly it was empty, easy travel and easier sight.
"Have you seen anyone?"
Dante craned his neck. It looked as barren as ever. He pushed back his hood, felt the cold breeze on his cheeks and nose and ears.
"Maybe."
He pushed his brows together.
"Ah, who knows? Been so long since I've seen anyone but you two Winguses, I'm probably imagining things."
Robert motioned them on. Somehow, Dante had stopped feeling the cold. He recognized its presence, knew if he'd appeared here after a week in the relatively balmy offshore breezes of Bressel, he'd be shaking like an epileptic. But for now, the chill no longer hurt. They rode downhill and were enfolded in the soft swell of the land. They rode uphill and were bracketed by mountains to the west and south, huge things of blue and white beneath the tight tarp of grey clouds. When Dante dismounted, he imagined his shoulders were still rocking to the gentle bounce of his horse. There was no proper road, as such, nothing paved or even rutted, just any number of dirt trails that joined and forked every few hours. But Robert checked Callie's map often, squinting at the course of the sun and, at night, at the particular dial of the stars. A river glinted to their west, and over the course of a day it swung to intersect their path. The ground angled down to meet it, and they cut through the snowy grass to drink fresh water and fill their skins with the cold mountain runoff. Dante spotted a bulge in the bank that created an eddy where fish might rest, but they had no poles, couldn't spear them from the shallows like he and Blaze had done at the pond. They'd made good time on the day, and Robert suggested they set up here and enjoy the rest of the afternoon. Dante and Blaze shrugged off their second shirts. It was still cold, but between the sunshine and the running around, they doubted they'd need them, and ranged down the river's banks, eyes sharp for the deep purple of Janberries. Dante judged they had about an hour of sunlight left.
It was the first honest free time they'd had since they'd left Gabe and his defense of Shay. The first time they'd had that wasn't spent riding or throwing together a shelter or hugging themselves and trying to remember what a fire felt like. And they ran beside the river, tagging each other with pine cones, cutting reedy branches and dueling in the late afternoon. Blaze twirled his branch beneath Dante's, with a smooth turn of his wrist, and pressed its springy tip against Dante's heart.
"Yield, you menace!"
"Never!" Dante said, cocking his elbow to strike at Blaze's neck, and Blaze rammed his stick forward. It bent against his cloak and doublet, then snapped two-thirds down its length. Dante waggled his weapon.
"Aha! You're unarmed!"
"And you're minus one heart," Blaze said, throwing what was left of his stick at Dante's feet. Dante turned toward the river and slung his like a spear. It disappeared into the waters, then bobbed back to the surface, straightening in the current. Blaze jogged up the bank a ways and called Dante over to a janberry bush, crouched against the foot of a pine. The purple berries were small and hard and sour, never truly in season, but it was good to taste anything fresh. All the food in their saddlebags was as dry as licking paper. They ate all they picked, then gathered a handful each for Robert, popping a few in their mouths as they backtracked toward the camp. They climbed a short ridge and saw Robert on his hands and knees in the grassy snow, peering across the waters. The boys froze and leaned into the nearest tree, following Robert's gaze. All Dante saw on the other banks was a few squat pines surrounded by bushes. He had a word half-formed when one of the bushes moved.
"Norrin. Four. Make that five of them. Swords at their belts, bows slung over their massive shoulders, staring right back at them."
Robert motioned for them to get down. Blaze made a long face at Dante, and Dante shrugged. The river washed between the two groups. Not quite a bow shot across, and the weapons the Norrin carried looked as tall and potent as the men who wore them. Blaze crammed the rest of his janberries into his mouth, then hesitantly raised a juice-stained hand. The Norrin stood as stolid as the hills behind them. Dante reached out for the nether, awaiting their move. One of them lifted a hand and waved back. Another dropped its eyes to whatever he'd been examining in the dirt and poked at it with a long staff. Their voices rumbled over the water. They talked a while, gesturing upriver, then turned as one and walked on.
"What was that all about?" Blaze said.
He spit out a stem.
"Looked like hunters," Dante said.
They started toward Robert, who was already striding their way down the shore.
"Next time, try not to bumble right into the war party," he said, glaring between them.
"Well, you could have said something," Blaze said.
"Yes, I really should have shouted, 'Watch out! There's some men over there that could probably kill and rob you if they wanted to bother.' Would that have done it?"
"What about a signal, whistling like a bird?" Dante said.
"What about you look around once in a while?" Robert said, poking him in the chest. "We're 500 miles from home. You've never stepped foot here, and I've only been here twice, neither of which was recent. Things are different now. If you don't keep your eyes open, you could be killed. You can't just be goofing around. Have some God's damned sense."
There was a long silence.
"I brought you some janberries," Dante said. He held out his berry-stuffed hand. Blaze ate all his.
Robert closed his eyes and sighed. He grabbed a few from Dante's palm and lobbed them into his mouth.
"Sour," he said. "They're janberries." "I know janberries are sour, I was just saying."
Robert ate a few more, face slackening as he munched.
"May as well follow the river for now.
Should be the Lagergansett, if I'm reading the map right. Find a town eventually, pick up some fresh food, then find a road straight to Narashtovik.
Plus plenty of janberries on the way," Blaze said,
tipping his chin at another bush a short ways down the bank. Just keep your stupid eyes open, Robert said, shaking his head. Those Norren were tracking deer, looks like. Water attracts all kinds of men and beasts. Probably see more of them before we see any chimney smoke.
Blaze gazed into the current.
Lagagaga? What the hell was it?
The river. Call it the river.
Right.
The Norren sightings increased their frequency the further they penetrated into the territories of the north. Blocky silhouettes on dawn ridges. Silent hunters crouched along steam beds, eyes gleaming from the thicket of their beards, tracking deer and elk through the snow. Sometimes Dante saw tracks so big it looked like two drunken children had been falling down every 4 feet. He tied the set of horns Gabe had given him to a length of leather string and draped it over his neck. They saw men, too. A single-sailed boat coasting down the river one afternoon, the twists of farmhouse smoke out on the flat expanse of the basin, a pair of raggedy travelers on foot who gave them one look before cutting away from the river into open land. It snowed one noon, adding a couple inches to the two or three already on the ground, going mushy and soggy once the sun broke back through the clouds. Villages began sprouting up every 10-odd miles, farming, fishing, the smoke of smithies. They'd passed two or three a day. Not yet wanting for food, desiring no contact with the locals, they toured around, cutting through the lightly treed fields and fallow farmlands. The ground got lower, and the snow got thinner, until one day it gave out altogether. For the first time in 2 weeks, they were able to light a fire. The boys leaned so close their damp clothes and blankets steamed.
Dante doused his bread in water and let it warm until it wouldn't crunch between his teeth for once.
In the mountains and the hills, they'd sometimes slept without keeping a watch, but in these lowlands, with the spark of their camp visible for miles in the night, they split shifts between watch and sleep. The nights were coming on the longest of the year, and even the 3 hours of guard duty spent sitting with their backs to the fire or pacing around the rim of light, they'd wait before dawn, fixing breakfast, chatting idly, waiting for the ground to grow gray enough for the horses to see.
"That spire there," Robert said the day they saw their first real town in these lands, pointing to the tall, dark finger of a temple sprouting from the middle of the city. "I've been there. Almost 20 years ago, but I was there."
"Does that mean we should go around?"
Blaze said, giving Dante a smirk.
"What? Of course not. Anyone who'd remember that's probably dead by now."
Robert rubbed his beard.
"I wouldn't recognize my face, at least. I'm sure they've forgotten."
"Oh,"
Blaze said. From a few miles out, it looked the same as the cities of the south. From half again as close, it smelled the same. Once they drew near enough for the buildings to resolve from grayish lumps to individual structures, Dante could see some of the outlying houses seemed to be roofed with sod. Not even the poorest houses were thatched, like he'd always seen in the outer ring of Bressel or down by the docks. These homes were roofed with steeply piled dirt, or tight-set planks or overlapped tiles of shale. The nobler manors and warehouses were set from firm, chunky, mortared stone. It looked like a city that would last 1,000 years after its last occupant had died.
"Looks all right to me," Dante said. "Wait a minute. I'm sure it will get horrible soon enough."
Robert took the lead toward the town.
"I mean, no fires, no fighting, no hordes of armed men. Where are Aron's faithful? Maybe it's already over," Blaze said.
Robert rubbed his mouth.
"Could be it hasn't started."
"But this is much closer to Narashtovik," Dante said. "That's where Samarand and her council lives. Things should be 10 times as crazy up here. What's going on?" Robert shrugged, then gave him a sharp look.
"Don't go asking any questions." They'll know we're foreigners anyway.
But they don't know we're stupid foreigners.
They won't think I'm stupid.
I do, Blaze said.
Yes, they will.
Robert ticked the numbers off on his fingers.
First, they'll think you're stupid because your accent's bad or you can't speak the language and you dress funny. Smell, too. Second, they'll think you're stupid because you don't know the things that everyone knows.
Why isn't your city burning to the ground, you'll ask.
And they'll look at you like you just tried to eat a loaf of bread through your arsehole.
That's what's stupid, Dante said. They'd be stupid to think that.
Well, why don't you just educate them as to the error of their ways, because that's how people think everywhere. Go on. You're not in any hurry, are you?
Fine.
I thought we were in a hurry, Blaze said.
We are, Dante said. Quit dawdling.
They rode into town. Other than the sturdier buildings, the occasional presence of Norrin rather than Kneeling, and the foreign language, Gascon, Dante presumed, since for the last few hundred miles they'd been in Gask and its territories, as far as anyone could be said to rule over the worthless lands around the Dundon Mountains, it didn't feel that much different. He'd never really paid attention to the traders and travellers who spoke Gascon back in Bressel, but with an ear cocked toward the tongue, he started to think he was going mad. It was a thicker, more imperative-sounding tongue, but it sounded just enough like Malish to make him think he could catch about every tenth word, if only they wouldn't speak so maddeningly fast. With a jolt, he realized he understood one of their words, and not from his native tongue, but from the cycle. To release or unlock.
They dress funny, Blaze said, nodding to a couple men wearing long, open-bottomed clothes that struck Dante as some kind of fur-lined dress.
Robert sighed. He took the lead and headed for the market, where they wandered around until they found a merchant who spoke enough Malish to sell them some fresh bread and dried meats, and could barter with Robert over a couple bottles of wine. Eventually they reached some kind of agreement, and Robert cradled his bottles and smiled out on the bustle of the market, the cries of the sellers and the guarded eyes of the buyers. Not all the smells were bad, either. For every whiff of old fish, there was one of cinnamon. For every sulphurous blast of hide tanning, there was the sweet, sagey lilt of lan leaves.
"Don't suppose we can spare a day or two here," Robert said.
"No," Dante said.
"That's why I said, don't."
Robert kept lingering, though, arguing with tradesmen in a broken combination of the two languages, sometimes resorting to exaggerated gestures and repeating himself very loudly. He bought some salt, some fresh-cooked crayfish, which he sucked from the shell, a bag of strong, bitter-smelling leaves.
"We'd better get moving," Dante said, checking the light.
"Good for another 10 miles, maybe."
"One last thing while we're here."
"Robert."
"Dante?"
Dante squeezed his teeth together. "We're not here to stuff ourselves with treats or take a wife. We need to go."
Robert bit his lip and took one last long look at the flash of coins changing hands, the laughter of men sharing a bottle, the wry faces of women sweeping doorways or naming the price of their vegetables. He nodded. Dante mounted up and led them on. Robert lagged at their tail, head turned over his shoulder, watching all those people fade into the waning light. The river unspooled across the land, bowing east and then back north, and they followed it across the days. From the berth of a few miles' distance, they saw the steeply pitched black roofs of another town dotted with snow. 3 days from the dead city, Dante reckoned. He tried to imagine what Narashtovic would look like, but all he could see was the twisting alleys of Bressel, the damp rotted docks, the overgrown clusters of houses ringing the city on 3 sides to the river. Half the city was fresh-cut wood, houses and halls that hadn't existed 50 years ago, to hear the old man talk. He couldn't picture a city that had been Bressel's rival when the last pages of the cycle had been penned 1,000 years ago. And once he was there, how would he complete his two tasks? Who would teach him to read the final third of the book? Would they have an academy? A forgotten library? Monks eager to teach the good word to those who'd come to hear? How could he hope to learn the dead language of Narashtivik and track down and kill Samarand at the same time? He didn't imagine it would be as simple as walking up behind her in the street and sticking a sword between her ribs. She was chief architect of all the chaos in the south. From what little he'd gathered, she was practically queen of a city that paid service in name only to the greater kingdom of Garsk. He knew he wasn't nearly potent enough to kill her in a fair fight, and wasn't nearly stupid enough to think her army of priests and retainers would let him get close enough to die that way in the first place. He wished Kali were with them. The old man would know what it would take. How had all this dropped on his shoulders? He and Blaze to end a war. It had seemed far less insane back when they were nestled safely in the temple outside Wetton. Here and now, with less than 100 miles to the end of their journey, it seemed to Dante the caprice of colossal miscalculation. This warranted armies or hardened assassins, not a pair of boys whose faces didn't even wrinkle when they smiled. They were going to die. 3 days from now, perhaps a week from now, but they were going to die. "What's so funny?" Blaze asked. "Our plan," Dante said. "The brilliant part about it is we can get as drunk as we want, because if we accidentally tell someone about it, they'd never believe a word." "Hilarious. Does that mean you've been working on it, then?"
"Yes."
"Oh," Robert said. "I've got to the part where we get to the city."
"Ah."
It was 2 more days till they climbed the brown mound of a low hill and saw the dead city. It consumed an entire quadrant of the horizon, a boundless smear of black and grey buildings, broken here and there by the windy spires of cathedrals and the closed fists of keeps, circumscribed by 2 concentric rings of walls, a bigger bulge of accumulated industry than Bressel itself, 10 miles across if it were an inch. 2 of its arms reached north to hold the grey waters of a bay, and beyond it the haze of the sea. Dante's face split with a smile. He'd come from shore to shore, well more than 1,000 miles, a distance he'd ever only dreamed of crossing. Whatever else befell him, by noon tomorrow he'd step foot in Narashtivik, the city of the book, the city of the dead. He had dreamed it, and then willed this dream to life. Robert stopped them the following morning some 10 miles from the city. He poured through a pack and passed around meat and cheese, stabbed a knife into the cork of a wine bottle, and twisted it open. He tipped it back into his waiting mouth, bubbles glugging into the bottle's upturned base, then wiped his lips and passed it to Blaze. Blaze chugged and passed it to Dante, and Dante had a sip. Robert sighed through his nose and considered the distant lumps of the city.
"Never feels right to say goodbye without a drink of wine," he said.
"I've never liked it at all," Dante said. Robert nodded.
"Who's leaving?"
Blaze said, handing the bottle back to Robert. "Are we sending off the horses? Why would we send off the horses?" Dante frowned at the ground. Robert chuckled, then went quiet when he realized Blaze meant no joke.
"We're not sending off the horses."
"Then what are you talking about?"
"It's time," Robert said.
He tapped his nails against the side of the bottle.
"Here's where I leave you two, to yourselves."
"Why?"
Blaze said. Just the one word, and Robert had to look away.
"You two have your mission. I'd just get in the way."
"No, you wouldn't. You're the best swordsman I've ever seen."
"What you need right now is not a sword. It's a story to tell the locals why you're here."
Two young men could be anything. Lordlings out to see the world, a pair of hired blades, a scholar and his man-at-arms. Whatever you say, they'll never imagine the two of you could be a threat, and that's the thing that will save your asses.
He took a drink and pushed his mouth against his sleeve, face red.
Some old bastard tagging along's just going to confuse them. Make them wary when you want to be a snake among the reeds. This whole thing seemed stupid and crazy when there were just the three of us.
Blazer's eyes shone with anger, and some roar hurt.
Now we're supposed to do it all with two? Trust me, you'll be better off. This calls for subtlety beyond my means.
And what if we're not enough to take her down? Blaze said, flinging his hand at the city.
What if they go and unleash her own? Maybe he will eat the world. Even if that's a steaming pile meant to rile things up, they look pretty damn safe up here.
The king's not going to march an army to the ends of the world when Samaran's got mobs burning up his backyard.
People are going to die.
Quit that, Robert barked.
Quit what? Saying what we've all been thinking?
Trying to shame me into this, you whelp, he said, stepping forward and sticking his finger into Blazer's chest. If I thought for a moment you two were skipping off towards suicide, I'd make you turn back right now, or at least rob you before the others could get to your corpses. First time I met you, Dante was busy lighting up the entire town watch, for God's sakes. And you killed plenty yourself as soon as your hands weren't tied. You two could set the world on fire if you wanted.
Blaze snatched the bottle away from him and had a pull.
Fine, he said, rapping the glass with his knuckles. Run off to your whores and your booze and your brawls. If you ever had a set of balls, they're far too shriveled to help us now.
Robert started to reply, then bit his teeth together. Lips curled. He looked away. When he spoke at last, his voice was forcibly softened.
Spill as many words as you want. I'm leaving. I know in my heart it's the right thing to do. Nothing can change that. The only thing left to settle is whether you'll remember me with darkness in your heart.
Get out, Blaze said.
Nobody moved.
He raised his arm and smashed the bottle against the frozen dirt. I said get the hell out!
Well enough.
Robert turned to Dante, face blank but eyes bright.
I think I've repaid whatever debt I owed you.
I never held you to any debt, Dante said.
I know, Robert grinned. That's the only reason I stuck around at all.
Dante nodded, gazed back the way they'd come.
Where will you go? Should have a few friends still kicking around these parts. Would be plain rude to come all this way and not say hello.
He sniffed, wiped his nose against the cold.
I'll be there in Wet and Blaze. You know where to look. Passed out in your own filth behind any public house,
Blaze said, back turned.
You were listening, after all.
Robert smiled for just a flicker, then flashed his eyebrows at Dante. He climbed into the saddle, wheeled his horse, began to backtrack the first of the miles. He halted 30 feet out and faced them. Blaze turned his head at the sudden silence of the horse's hooves.
Walk with the gods, boys. Don't you dare let them get you before you get them.
Dante watched him ride away. At 100 yards, Robert dropped down a ridge and left his sight. Dante nodded to himself. He'd see Robert Hovel again, he pledged. And when he did, he'd bring Blaze with him.
You don't look too surprised, Blaze said, face matching the dark clouds overhead that hadn't yet decided to spill their burden.
You saw how he was in that town. He's been saying he meant to leave us since Gabe's.
I didn't think he meant it.
Dante shook his head, a flare of frustration budding in his chest.
He means every word he says.
He does, Blaze agreed. He kicked a stone,
Dante couldn't think of a single thing to say to soften what had happened. He stared dumbly at the dead city, thinking 10 miles. 10 miles, 2 hours if we hurry, and 3 if we don't. 10 miles. 10 miles. As if all he had to do was think hard enough, and they'd shrink away to none. He risked a look at Blaze.
"Want a rest before we finish it?" he said. "When we're this close? What are you, a girl? A baby? I want to see this fancy city of yours."
"It's not mine. Yet." He nudged his horse forward. A breeze followed him. He imagined he smelled the faint scent of salt water.
"Gabe told me before the attack you ought to name your sword."
Blaze glanced at his side as if he'd forgotten it was there.
"Name my sword?"
"He said it might give it power."
Blaze laughed and pulled it free. Sun glinted down its steel as he waved it in front of his face.
"You believe him?"
"All the famous warriors do it," Dante said, lifting half his mouth. "They must be onto something."
Blaze slitted his eyes, nodded. Air whistled over his swing. He smiled grimly.
"I dub thee Robert Slayer."
"Now come on," Dante said.
"It's my sword. I can name it what I want." "What kind of name is Robert Slayer?"
"It's a vow," Blaze said, brows furrowed like Dante was stupid for asking. "Next time I see him, I'm going to challenge him to a duel."
"What about all the help he gave us?" Dante said.
He tried and failed to see any hint of humor in Blaze's eyes.
"I'm not saying I'm going to kill him."
Blaze held the sword level with his arm and peered down its length.
"Just slosh some of his blood around. Show him who's the whelp."
"All right." Dante freed his own weapon from its sheath.
"I think I'll name mine Blaze Chopper. The gods will know you're copying. Your blows will land as falsely as its name."
"You've got a direct line to them, do you?
You have chat." "I know how these things work," Blaze said, cutting the air between them. "You can't just name your sword a joke. You named yours Robert Slayer. And it's going to taste his blood," Blaze insisted.
His lips twitched. "The only blood of mine you'll ever taste will be my skinned knuckles and your teeth."
"I'd burn you to a cinder first," Dante said, pointing to him with the first 2 fingers of his right hand.
"You'd set me on fire?"
Blaze gave him a look of mock horror. Dante laughed, looked off toward the city, for a moment felt as if things were back how they'd been before they'd ever met Callie and been so ensnared in all these problems of churches and kingdoms. Things were different now, though. They rode not solely for the lives of themselves, but for those of thousands in the Southlands. They rode with the cold force of a mortal purpose. Through it all, they carried the weight of the men they'd killed on the way. The dead city took the land before them, boundless and ragged, black and ancient as the earth's first wound.
Chapter 12 Narashtivik grew wider with every step, taller with every minute. Its outskirts were a tumble of old stone and mouldering wood, tainted everywhere by a confusion of indistinct black smears, as if 100 years ago an all-consuming fire had chewed the city up and left the ashy remnants to the slow erosion of time. But from the city's interior, wispy columns of smoke twisted into the seaside haze of sky.
"Stay sharp," Dante said. "Someone still lives here."
"Sorry, I was lost in the rugged beauty of that giant mound of trash up there."
Once they drew nearer, Dante saw the black spaces weren't charcoal and shadow, but the deep green needles of northern pines. Thick in the streets, pushing up among the tumbled stones, choking out the places where men once lived. They'd make easy firewood. But there they were, unmolested, undisturbed. Dante touched the pair of horns that hung from his neck. The tracks of others broke the crust of snow that lay on the road. From within the jumble of houses and trees, he thought he could see the shadows of movement. Far too few for a city of this scope. The silhouettes he saw lived in the lawless ruins, wouldn't necessarily bear the mantle of docility that seemed to affect most men who lived in the company of thousands of others. Dante closed one eye, reached out for the nether, felt it reach back. He led his horse around a tongue of rubble that lay on the roadway. They left the pine-speckled fields and crossed into the sprawl of empty buildings. Once or twice a minute, he saw a man hurrying across one of the streets ahead, heard the footfalls of inhabitants from somewhere within the alleys and cross-streets. Further toward the city's heart, he'd catch a shout, a bell, a few moments of breeze-scattered blacksmith's hammer blows. He slowed his horse, watching both sides of the road as they passed the moss-coated stump of a home that couldn't have stood for 200 years. Then an open patch of half-buried timbers that may once have been an in-house but now looked one strong rain from washing down to a square of dirt, no different than any of the rest. Then a weed-choked foundation resting bare of walls or roof. From the distance of a mile or more, an uneven line of grey stone showed behind the worn roofs of those buildings that still stood.
"Tell me why this feels wrong," Dante said. "Where should I start?"
"I don't mean that," Dante said, jerking his chin at the detritus.
"Callie made it sound like we'd be trussed up in a net and thrown in a stew the instant we showed up."
Blaze chewed the inside of his lip.
"I don't see a damn thing, and all I hear is one smith who can't keep time."
"That's it. There's not enough noise. You can separate one sound from another." Blaze nodded. He loosened his sword. They followed the road. Not all was empty, not all was ruin. Some houses boasted all four walls and a roof without holes, and here and there wooden structures that didn't look completely decrepit shared walls with older ones. The chock of a solitary wood axe echoed from no more than 100 yards away. Down a street where the cobbles were as gappy as the teeth of a serf, Dante caught the unexpected flash of a garden, an ordered spread of green amongst the defeated crumble of housing. A man's soughing footsteps came from the other side of the street, and he turned in time to see a pair of wary eyes before the figure disappeared behind a damp wall. They moved on. Voices and the clanking of men at their labor grew thicker as they approached the city's first wall. It shared the disrepair of the lands around it, webbed with cracks, its top as jagged as the peaks they'd crossed weeks earlier. Graying, fluttery lumps dangled from spears planted in the stone. In places, there was no wall at all, just a carpet of stones, and beyond it, a view of the city that looked half normal. The road led to a gate of sorts, or at least one space in a stonework that was intentional, though Dante saw no sign of a grill or doors to shut the 20-foot walls against invasion. They halted a stone's throw from its base and moved off to the sod at the side of the road to dismount, stretch their legs, have a bite. Foot and carriage traffic moved on the other side of the gates. If they hadn't just crossed through a couple miles of desolation, Dante could almost imagine it was a city no different from any other.
"I don't suppose you've any idea what you're doing," Blaze said.
"Not really," Dante said, and the admission lifted a weight from his shoulders. He gazed back at all the empty buildings.
"At least we won't have any trouble finding a place to stay."
"Yeah." Blaze flexed up on his calves and crossed his arms, watching the signs of life past the gate.
I was kind of expecting to have had to kill someone by now.
Dante nodded and chewed on a bite of bread.
Dirt peppered their legs, and they jumped back. 6 feet in front of them, an arrow vibrated in the soil like a plucked string.
Outstanding, Blaze said.
He twisted it from the dirt and gazed up at the walls, patting the arrow's head against his leg.
I believe that was a warning.
More dirt spattered them, and again they heard the twang of an arrow coming to rest in the earth. The second had landed a mere cubit from Blaze's boots. He gaped.
Who shot that?
Dante lifted an open palm and turned a slow semicircle in front of the gate. He didn't know whether Malish customs would mean anything here, but figured if they were bright enough to know how bows worked, they'd get the picture. Blaze yanked out the second arrow and snapped it in half, casting the fragments into the street.
Don't, Dante said, scanning the crest of the wall for movement.
Tell them not to shoot at me.
We're travelers,
Dante called up to the fortifications.
That's why I shot at you.
A voice came back from up and to the right. In Malish at that, not the barking language of this land. Dante squinted at the horizon of stone and sky.
Stop shooting at us, Blaze said.
State your business, the voice said.
Blaze sucked air and looked at Dante. Dante pushed out his lip and shrugged.
A critical error of preparation, Blaze murmured.
Dante nodded.
Another arrow hissed over their heads and tinked off a wall somewhere behind them. State your business in Narashtavik or join the others on this wall, the voice called out.
And Dante took a step back as he re-examined the grey things stuck from the spears along its top.
What was wrong with mankind?
Got it,
Dante said to Blaze, then raised his voice and tipped his face toward where he thought the guard was emplaced.
We're pilgrims of the south. We've come to pay homage to Aron in the city that is his most holy.
Aron? Blaze hissed. Are you trying to get us killed?
Dante waited, sucking breath through his teeth. No more arrows creased the air. The walls stood silent.
What should I have said? He whispered to Blaze. We're merchants here to sell our invisible wagons of riches. I didn't hear you brimming with suggestions. What about all those great lies Robert came up with? At least they've stopped trying to kill us. Unless they're on their way down so they can get their hands involved.
What are your names? The voice said, and the two boys jumped.
John Girdle and Bob Oxman,
Blaze called before Dante could give their real ones.
Him being John, of course. What kind of names are those? Dante whispered.
What kind of names are those? The voice shouted.
The ones our fathers gave us,
Blaze roared back. He was met with more silence. The breeze ruffled the needles of the pines, the refuse in the streets.
Very well, John Girdle and Bob Oxman, the voice said at last. You may enter. The sermon of Samarand will be at noon, 3 days from now.
The boys looked at each other. Dante cupped his hands to his mouth.
Where exactly? The Cathedral of Ivars, the voice said slowly. Where did you say you were from?
The south, Blaze said.
Indeed, the voice said. Enter then.
They grabbed the reins of their horses and walked them forward. Dante kept his eyes on the part of the wall where the man had spoken from until the stone cast its shadow on them, and they stepped into the next circle of the city. He glanced toward Blaze as they made their way up the road and into the company of others. John Girdle and Bob Oxman, indeed. What if the gatekeeper hadn't let them pass? What would they have done then? Would they have died in the street among the filth and the ruin? It was a strange world, he thought. A horrible one, an ongoing rush of violence and confusion where no place felt like home. The wrong words could make his stomach churn with loathing for his failure, could make others move to strike him down. Where did Blaze find his bluster? For all his own mind had opened since he'd found the book, the only moments that didn't feel like a test that found him wanting were when he was reading or when he'd said something to make Blaze laugh. What was the rest of it? The running from those who would kill them, the riding to this city for the one they would kill? And if they managed to make that so, would anything be different once Samarand was dead? Wouldn't he always feel this way? Wouldn't he always be worried to the nub of his nerves by the memories of the foolish things he'd said, the times he'd tried and come up short, the moments he'd reached within himself and found he didn't have the strength to act at all? "She's here," he said, staring dumbly at the space between his horse's ears.
"Where?"
Blaze said, hands snapping to his sword.
"I mean, in the city."
"Didn't we know that already?"
"Not for certain, did we?"
Blaze screwed up his face.
"I thought you and Callie were certain she was here. I thought that's why we decided to ride 1,000,000 miles to get here. Are you saying we could have come all this way and had to turn right back around?"
"No," Dante said, slowing as they reached an intersection with another broad avenue.
"Well, yes." "You son of a bitch!"
"All's well that ends well, right?" He was about to make fun of Blaze's concerns some more, but was suddenly too busy collecting his jopped drawer.
"Do you see that?"
Blaze followed his finger.
"See what? That you haven't washed your finger in 5 years?"
"That's a temple of Aron," Dante said, pointing down the street at the white trees standing in relief above the double doors on the face of a tall, spired structure missing most of its roof and pitted with ware on its walls. Fine-boned gargoyles stood watch on its eaves.
"So? I thought this was their capital."
"Out in the open like that. It looks hundreds of years old. It would have been burnt down 12 different times back in Bressel." Blaze made a smacking sound with his lips, then just sighed instead.
"I suppose you want to look inside."
"Hells yes I do," Dante said. All the dread he'd felt toward himself and his surroundings a minute earlier lifted like a fever dream. What was this place?
"Should we just put these horses in our pockets?"
"What?"
"Oh."
Dante glanced around the square. The couple of men on about their business, the dark windowed faces of steep-roofed buildings.
"Let's just stash them behind someplace empty. It still looks pretty clear."
Blaze snorted.
"Thieves are like roaches. Everything looks clear to the moment they're running off with your food."
"Then we'll steal someone else's horses later," Dante said. "Just carry anything you can't replace. Don't forget your blankie."
"And just leave our mounts for the first guy with an eye for easy money."
"Yes? We're in the city now. They're practically a burden. Oh, what should we do with the horses? Should we stable them? When did we last pay the groomsmen? Should we just tie them up?
What if someone robs us? The horror!"
"Oh, if only we didn't have these horses." Dante stopped waving his hands around. "You see?"
"But I like them,"
Blaze said, patting his horse's neck.
"There's a time to let things go," Dante said.
He turned his horse down a narrow road, and they wandered a while in the rows of mostly whole buildings lined against the city wall. He chose one that looked particularly abandoned. The trash looked old and gray, no boot prints in the yard, no smoke from the chimney, or any of the other holes in the roof, and they tied their horses to a pine sapling that had shot up through the front stoop. Dante led Blaze back toward the temple, orienting himself by the wall behind him and the cluster of spires toward the city's center. The door creaked like the planks of a ship, but opened easily enough. Weak sunlight diffused through the broken and shutterless windows. The ground floor was filth. Apple cores and chicken bones and eye-wild potatoes and small mouldering piles that may have been edible a year or five ago, or, judging by the smell, may already have been eaten once. Clouds of crumpled paper sat in front of the fireplace of the front hall. Dante smoothed one against his knee. The alphabet was foreign, but he knew enough to know the name of Aron when he saw it. They stepped carefully past the refuse to the back rooms beyond the mostly empty great hall, and found more of the same. Clearly the temple had been used more recently for the housing of the penniless than as a home of the god. A wooden staircase, missing only a few slats, rose to the second floor. Dante tested its footing, keeping close to where the steps met the wall. They squeaked like cancerous rats. Blaze followed him up, face tight, spitting curses each time the boards popped or groaned.
"We could have found these same wondrous treasures out in the gutters, you know."
"But not this," Dante said, crossing the landing to a bookshelf behind some smashed-up tables. Three quarters empty, and when he picked up what works were left, most of them sloughed rotten pages over his feet, or dangled as empty covers, the leaves stolen for starting fires or far less dignified ends. A handful of intact and legible volumes remained, however, and three of those were even in a language he could read. He wedged them into his pack and turned in a circle, looking out on the dust and the kipple.
"Let's try the spires."
"Let's," Blaze agreed, much too enthusiastically, but he tailed Dante up the solid stone stairs they found at the far rear of the temple. The only things left in the upper floors were a number of plain iron candelabras and horn-hewn statuettes, a lot of wood chips, and a few axe-scarred tables which had evidently been too much trouble to haul downstairs and burn. Dante picked up a thumb-sized carved imp and handed it to Blaze.
"Here, he'll ward away your troubles."
Blaze held it up in Dante's face and frowned. He held it beside his ear, shook it.
"It's not working."
"Funny," Dante said. The temple had long since been scoured of nearly everything that could be sold or set on fire, and they finished their search within minutes and re-entered the street. The horses hadn't been stolen from where they'd tied them in front of the old house by the wall, and finding the premises no less dirty than the streets and far cleaner than the temple or either of the house's neighboring edifices, the boys settled in. The sun was just saying hello to the western horizon. Dante lit a couple candles looted from the temple and set them at either end of the house's main room. That is, the only other room besides the one the front door opened on.
"We should find the Cathedral of Ivars tomorrow," he said, easing himself to the floor. He rocked back and forth on the hardwood. "Feels weird not to have bumps beneath your ass."
Blaze gave him a look, then moved on.
"Going to be a lot of people. I get the impression we weren't the first pilgrims the gatekeeper'd seen."
"I'm just saying, we know she'll be there. We should see if it's an option."
"I doubt it'll be a good one."
"Thus, the scouting." Dante exhaled hard. "It can't hurt to look. Maybe it'll be perfect." Blaze shrugged.
"Let's not be in some big hurry to make it the first option. I'd prefer to leave here on my feet than on my back."
Dante got out one of the books he'd found in the old church. Its cover bore the inky silhouette of a man holding out his hand to a rat.
"It's going to be a risk no matter how we do it."
"There are risks and there are risks," Blaze said, wandering around the far side of the room. He slipped a finger under one of the slats nailed over the window and gave an exploratory tug.
"You know."
"I know," Dante said. But 3 days from then, they'd be looking on Samarand with their own eyes. Whatever risks it carried, whatever else it would mean for his other goal within the City of the Dead, the opportunity would be there. And if it looked right, they'd be fools not to take it.
"We'll see how things look tomorrow."
Through force of habit, they were up well before the sun. Dante rose first and lit a candle in the other room and skimmed the new additions to his library. The first was a sort of rebuttal to the cycle, fleshing out historical detail of its major figures, and often diverging into windy lectures about the way its theology failed to account for the fundamental and contradictory truths of Menoch and Carvajal. Its penultimate chapter purported to examine the final third of the cycle of Aron, the part written in ancient Narashtavik, and Dante plunged into it with a pounding heart. But after a dozen odd pages, Dante found it scarce on actual references and long on opinion. Fascinating to the author's scholarly circle, Dante was certain, and would perhaps have been of interest to him if he'd first been familiar with the source material, but for the meantime, infinitely boring. The second tome, the one with the man and the rat on its cover, was, as anyone could have guessed, a slim volume devoted entirely to Jack Hand. A lucky find, but irrelevant to its present purpose. He smiled and set it aside. The third told the tale of the two-part war, what later became known as the Second Scour. Dante's knowledge of that time was hazy at best, and he read until Blaise woke, absorbing the tale of Malon's ill-fated crusade 400 years ago through the Dundons into Gask, where hard winters had regularly left their forces underarmed and poorly fed, weakening them until they'd been in no condition to drive out the Gascon counter-thrust to their northeast territories, which had menaced the neighboring lands until King Sarl I had been forced to sign treaty, granting Aron's faithful, in all Malon, freedom of worship. A treaty that had been broken 8 years later, when the other houses declared they could no longer stand for such blasphemy in their homeland. Sleep had mostly dried away the sunken mood Dante'd entered after their encounter with the arrow-firing gatekeeper, and as he read, the last of his depression burned away, leaving his mind light and swift, renewed under the warm glare of written words. But for Dante's finds, interesting as they were, he was yet no closer to understanding the remainder of the cycle than when they'd left Shea. Somewhere in this city, he had to find the key. They ate a cold breakfast and decided to venture out on foot, reasoning the horses might command respect, but they'd command double that in attention. Dante was certain the Aronites were still searching for him, but was fairly convinced they'd lost his trail and didn't know how to get it back. He doubted they had anything more than a vague description of his appearance, and wanted to give no watchers any reason to look his way twice. After 20 minutes of aimless walking, and another 30 of fruitless attempts to get directions from other pedestrians, Dante was considering heading back for the horses, if only so the next time his malish words were met with a sneer, he could just trample the offender to death. Finally, they lounged in an unused doorway on one of the busier streets, and tried to look undisturbably dangerous till they heard words they could understand. They fell on the two men who'd spoken their language, swords swinging from their belts, maneuvering themselves between the men and the open street. "I swear I'll run the next man through who brushes us off," Blaise muttered loudly as they approached. "Pardon me, but are you able to direct us to the Cathedral of Ivars?" Dante said to the pair, tilting back his head and shooting for an air of ironic embarrassment. "Easily," the taller of the two said, glancing between the road-worn faces of the boys. "Follow the road through the inn gate, then make straight for the citadel. The cathedral will be the rather large thing across from its gates." He considered the cluster of structures towards the middle of the city. "In fact, you can see its spire there," he said, pointing over the roofs to the titanic arm of a steeple standing across from what appeared to be a single enormous block of grey stone. The structures were a couple miles away, faint through the smoke and the early morning haze of the bay, but indisputable, the clear heart of Narashtavik.
"I see," Dante said.
"Oh, thanks, kind sirs," Blaise said. "Right," Dante said.
We'd been warned of the aloofness of this city, but hadn't warranted it would extend to the honest faithful.
Indeed, the shorter man said, eyes flicking down their shabby clothing and unkempt faces. You've traveled far.